That's Segundo here, and I'm feeling a tad happy. It seems there's been a slight good fortune. You see, on a whim, I purchased one of those lottery scratch-off tickets. Now, I'm skeptical of such scams, seeing as how they take advantage of poor schmucks like me, who look for a quick score when traveling down the road to abject poverty. Well, this ticket garnered a $20 win. I was happy to reclaim this, but it seems that getting the prize involves filling out a lengthy form with all sorts of personal information. This was the moment my happiness ended. You see, my privacy was compromised, and I'm now waiting for this state-sponsored cheapskates to send me a prize, a check, anything. It's only $20. Well, perhaps there's another Bat Segundo out there who will steal my hard-earned $20 away from me. Perhaps he's stealing my identity right now, much like the way this T.C. Boyle guy seems equally concerned with the way that identity is now exposed more frequently than my genitals are to a lap dancer. Well, we've had Mr. Boyle on our program before, but we've never had him quite like this. You, dear listener, make the call.
So I am here once again with another repeat guest. This time it's T.C. Boyle, who has another novel out, which is the 362nd book I think you've authored, called Talk Talk.
Well, thank you, Ed, and welcome to my fancy hotel on Nob Hill. Now, I have just had a wonderful experience of going to the restroom, and I noticed that I had a choice between ladies and gentlemen. And it made me reflect on the fact that it'd be a much more interesting world if it required five or six different sexes in order to reproduce. And we could have five or six different rooms, ladies, gentlemen, and whatever else there might be. I posited this way back in Budding Prospects. There, I invented a science fiction writer whom I've trotted through some of my novels ever after, Filencio Salmon, and he wrote The Ravishers of Pentagord, in which it did require five or six, I think six, different combinations in order to just get off.
Yeah. There's actually...
It's so boring.
I was going to remark that you ripped off that idea from Lawrence Durrell, because he actually posited in one of those four books of having like 23 or 24 different genders.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have read those books.
Yes.
But I wasn't aware of ripping him off or that it was coming from him. But, you know, everything is simmering there in the distant past, maybe.
Well, we'll talk about literary references later. But in the meantime, I want to talk about kind of tying into the last time we chatted, in which you expressed a certain sort of pessimism with the reading public, how they don't read. And here you are with a thriller. And I'm wondering if this was one of the reasons that attracted you to the thriller genre. Did you want to sort of increase your audience base?
Or? Ed, what a provocative question. No, not at all. In fact, I don't consider it a thriller. My publisher wants to call it a thriller because I think it has certain connotations for the reading public. You know, if they call it a literary novel, they think, I mean, not the anointed, you know, who are going to read me anyway, but the ones who might not have read me before. I'm uneasy with that terminology because I've never read a thriller in my life. Of course, I've seen thriller movies, you know, and I know the conventions of it. And I've seen Alfred Hitchcock's movies. I'm not a thriller kind of guy. I'm not a genre writer. This is just another story. I think that everything I've done is thrilling, and you can find precedents for this novel in many of my short stories.
Yeah.
Killing Babies, for instance. So I don't really, I think it's just something the publisher wants to do because it makes people's ears perk up. But I think you know me well enough to know that I do not calculate these things. I write about what interests me. And it occurs to me that this is my first contemporary setting since The Georgia Curtain, which you could say is a kind of thriller. The Brits called it a thriller when it came out over there.
Yeah.
But, you know, come on.
But the undeniable sort of like first several chapters are just like, let's go ahead and grab the reader by the lapels and just like, you know, totally throw them into this story,
Absolutely.
Which is very, very much like a thriller.
Absolutely. And I'm glad and proud and pleased to have done it. And I hope to do it again in the future. Well, but of course, the novel I'm working on now is totally the polar opposite of this.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask, because I mean, this book reminded me me very much of Anthony Burgess's sort of experiment with the thriller, or rather his effort to write a Graham Greene novel called Tremor of Intent.
I've never read that one.
It's a failure, but it's an interesting failure, because here he, not, which is not to say I actually liked your book, don't worry, but he, what he did is, towards the beginning, he's kind of, you know, satirizing certain kinds of elements of the Graham Greene spy thriller. He makes the spy this totally inept sort of person. And likewise, when I was reading you the first 100 pages of this book, it's like, well, he's kind of like, you know, to some degree, this is a little bit more like, you know, playful in a sort of narrative fashion.
Oh, of course.
Than the norm. But then at the same time, midway through the book, I get the sense that, oh, I can't entirely, you know, whether it be pseudo-thriller, whether it be thriller, whether it just be novel, I can't entirely sort of, you know, mock the genre entirely. I have to actually embrace it. And I was wondering if this kind of came into your mind, if there was any kind of, you know, narrative component that if you haven't read a thriller, then what were the influences?
Well, I've read Graham Greene, certainly.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I don't approach things in this way. I don't think I'm going to adopt the form of a thriller in order to subvert it. I'm simply writing a story. This is the way it goes. I follow it to see what will happen. Yes, obviously, I think readers will enter this and have a great read and see that I'm having fun with the conventions of the thriller. For instance, in the ending,
yeah.
Obviously, I'm not going to give you the grade B punch 'em up with the maniac climbing out of the mattress. My intentions are much deeper than that. I'm talking about identity. What is identity? How do you know who you are? We know through language, you know through communication. And the ending here, as it came to me, pulls you back into the book to think about that and to focus on that.
Yeah.
And so I don't think a thriller would do this. A conventional thriller would give you that shoot 'em up, bang 'em up kind of ending. But what does that leave you with? It leaves you with a black and white picture. The good guy is always purely good, and the bad guy is purely bad. It doesn't really leave you with anything other than a satisfaction of revenge. That's basically what they do.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in that. Not at all.
Well, I suspected when you were writing this that you seemed to sympathize more with Peck than with Dana and Bridger, because Peck comes across as this very sort of exuberant kind of foe. I mean,
It's certainly something I was aware of. Old John Milton had the same problem when he wrote Paradise Lost. Lucifer was so witty and engaging that Jesus was going to be he was going to be a hard act to follow for Jesus in the sequel. I think what happened is that, as in Tortilla Curtain, there are shadings in these characters, just like in real people. I mean, most people. I, of course, am saintly and perfect, but most people, have many different impulses. In the opening of Tortilla Curtain, I sympathize with Delaney Mosbacher. He's like me. He wants to recycle. He loves the environment, et cetera, et cetera. And I would like to think that I would act generously and heroically in the situation that he found himself in when he ran over the Mexican immigrant on the road.
Yeah.
But maybe I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Maybe I would be just like him. Maybe I would be venal. And so in this book, I think readers may enjoy the fact that the characters surprise them. That is, Dana is not a victim, and she is not particularly likable. You're rooting for her, but you're also rooting for Peck. And yet, if you step back a bit, you see that she has been victimized, and we all are being victimized by this crime, and that Peck is engaging because he wants to find an identity that suits him. He's not content with who he is, as many of us are not, as novelists are not.
Yeah.
But, in fact, when you look through his rationalizations, that is, I'm not hurting anyone, insurance companies pay for it, you see that he is a bad guy. He's a narcissist. He's a narcissistic personality who doesn't see that other people have an independent existence or an independent will. So he reminds me very much of characters whom I love to write about, like Dr. Alfred C. Kinsey or Dr. Kellogg.
Mm-hmm. Well, also the interesting thing about comparing Peck with Dana and Bridger is that You have Peck actually has initiative. Dane and Bridger do not really. They're sort of like, you know, expecting kind of the world to sort of support them and to sort of hold their hands and to, like, you know, exactly. actually like pursue, you know, the prosecution of this crime, only exactly. to find that it's a considerably anarchic place in this book. And I guess part of me suspected that you sort of enjoyed. It's not just the fact that he is sort of like, you know, Lucifer. It's Peck is Lucifer. It's also the fact that Peck has actually this kind of initiative that Dale, Dana and Bridger don't have.
Well, Bridger in particular interested me in that so many of us today are sort of media hogs and, you know, and computer sluggards and live in a virtual reality. And that is Bridger. He's never really had to confront much in his life. He's doing fine. He's making a living in special effects. He has an ambition to do more, of course, but will he? I don't know. He reflects on this, in fact, when he goes off and has to make a commitment. And the commitment is to her and to give up his job and his prospects in pursuit of the great white whale, you know. This sort of character stands in opposition to someone who is dynamic like Peck. And yet, Bridger's a good guy, you know. He's a good guy. He's working... In a field that he loves. He loves fantasy. He loves film. He's always worked in film. And it came to me that his technique in special effects, of head replacements, for instance, of paint and roto, is another way of messing with or concealing or changing identities.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's also creating his own world, which might sort of at least the suggestion here is that he's not actually able to access the real world. He figures that he can go in, bail out Dana, and no, it's not quite like that.
I love your interpretation. Yeah. Absolutely. If anything, I've learned over the years of writing, I can't say whether I'm getting better or worse, or, you know, or there's progress or I'm regressing, or I don't know. I mean, that's not for me to say. But if anything, I think I've learned to engage my characters more and do more with character than simply with design. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at my very first stories, I'm much more interested in design, and characters are necessary, of course, as part of a design. Now I think I see them in a more organic way, and I'm pleased that readers are finding different shadings in these characters and complexities that help to reinforce the themes. And again, this is nothing that happens abstractly. This is something that happens in the process of moving forward daily with a given story. And as you know from our previous conversation, I work in a very intuitive way. I think that's the way art is made. Yeah. And it progresses by accretion. And somehow, in this long process, my unconscious is able to make these connections that I couldn't make in a conscious way.
But at the same time, I would also argue with the first 100 pages in particular that, you know, Tom the Sadist here is really at work here and creates probably one of the most sadistic sort of situations I think I've seen in your work for a long time.
Yeah, you know, I was talking with someone yesterday who said it's kind of a horror story. And when I was doing the initial research on identity theft, before I had an idea of how I was going to broaden the debate or the look into it, I was thinking, man, I'm getting paranoid. This is pretty horrifying stuff.
Yeah, it is.
And of course, what happens to Dana has happened to other people. In fact,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you yourself had, I know, some jail time experience as well.
Well, people are asking me, how do I know the jail so intimately? Well, I've been inside a jail at once. I think most people have. It's not very pleasant. Yeah. But again, I'm not the sort of writer who comes from a journalistic background. I've always simply been an artist. And so, unlike a Tom Wolfe, for instance, I don't go to the jail and talk to the cops and see what kind of belt they're wearing and write down some of their dialogue to get their argo. I am much more interested in a flight of the imagination and letting it go where it will, which is not to say that I want to be sloppy about my facts. I want to make it as credible as possible. Sure. But I'm making it credible through research and imagination, as opposed to going to the cops and hanging out with them and schmoozing with them and so on and so on. I'd be very uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, I'm just wondering why. I mean, identity theft is not for those who forget that there was actually a time before the internet. I mean, identity theft is not new. You could have pursued, like, for example, Cassie Chadwick, who impersonated the daughter of Andrew Carnegie, or potential people. I was wondering, why did you set this in contemporary times? Why not, like, you know, explore Cassie Chadwick?
Oh, of course, and I wish I'd known. Maybe I'll do that in the next novel. Just write it down for me. Yeah. Of course, there's always been impersonation. And the history of literature is rife with the doppelgangers. In fact, William Wilson himself. The name is, of course, from the Poe story, William Wilson, about the doppelganger. I do feel, though, that because of our technology today and our burgeoning population and the fact that we no longer live in villages in the same place for an entire lifetime, our identities have become much more fluid. And identity theft, of course, is a crime that's much easier to commit and far more pervasive than it has ever been. So pervasive that soon we will go to biometrics for every transaction. Yeah. And this also begs the question, then, of personal liberty.
Yeah.
And things we've talked about in the past in terms of a consumer society and what it means in terms of its ultimate goal. Its ultimate goal is simply to produce more consumers and more product and to sell more product. In fact, I've come to believe that that is the purpose of life. What is the purpose of life? To buy product, obviously, is the purpose of life.
And look at the shopping cart, which is the device that homeless people use. There's a great irony in that. You know?
There is. And I think that the idea of identity theft and its correction, which will be a retinal scan, it's just another digging away at our liberties, so that really we are far less individuals than we might have been before the technological age, simply because we had more limitations. But we are tracked by the government. We are tracked. By the way, I don't know about you, but Bush is on to me. He knows how much I despise what he's done to our country, and I think there's a predator drone following me.
Yeah.
Everywhere I go. I think it's hovering over the hotel right now, and I hope that you're not a collateral damage in this.
I've encouraged friends to sort of, we talk about assassination attempts on Bush and, various sort of terrorist rings that we have operating, of course, so the NSA
you probably do have a drone as well.
There's see that, behind that stairwell over there.
But at any rate, the card that you use at the supermarket, well, you get a discount, great, but then they target you and they know your habits and they know everything. Yeah. There's so much information on us that it makes it difficult to be an individual anymore or to have an identity that you would choose for yourself. Mm-hmm. I am not as plugged in as most people, as you know.
Yeah.
I like to shut it off. I don't carry a cell phone. Yes, I have my son's cell phone right now because I'm on tour, but I don't carry it and I'm uncomfortable with it. I'm uncomfortable with revealing myself in public, unless, of course, I'm on stage or it's been programmed for me to do that.
Yeah.
I like to spend time by myself. I like to be alone. I like to be unconnected, disconnected. But most people are not and do not have that privilege or even desire or even knowledge of the fact that they can be disconnected.
So really it seems that you needed to kind of come back to a contemporary setting to explore the cell phone connection, the fact that we are, crippled to some degree by technology.
Absolutely.
And that we're also so flexible and adaptive to go ahead, okay, cell phone. I've got a cell phone here, It's like me, the person who said, 5 years ago, I will never get a cell phone. Now I use it all the time.
Absolutely. I will give this back to my son, and I will not carry one.
Yeah.
He's in Costa Rica. My wife gave. I pay for four of them, but I never use them, and I don't want them. I don't want to have people be in contact with me. I have an agent. I have an editor. They have cell phones. That's what they're for, you know?
Yeah.
I really do want to be private and to have contemplative time, and it seems that we get less and less of it in society, and we have less and less of an identity, aside from the fact that we are ciphers in the government's corporation that it owns to control us in the way of a banana republic,
Yeah.
and to sell us stuff from birth till death.
But, you know, people have been making these arguments, though, irrespective of technology, because you have, for example, the Kitty Genovese situation from the 60s, where people, like, said, oh, yes, humanity is isolated, or they're not, you know, or they're too connected, or they're not connected enough to actually have the basic sort of ability to keep a vigilant eye. I mean, you know... They'll continue making these arguments over and over.
Well,
of course.
So. And it does speak to the idea of privacy and how that affects your identity.
Yeah.
In the Kitty Genovese thing, as in many other similar crimes, people are locked away and walled away from each other and don't know their neighbors and don't want to know their neighbors. And this comes back to Dana and the deaf community.
Yeah.
I grew up in New York, on the street. Keep your distance. I don't want anything from anybody. And the deaf will have a very difficult time. As a foreigner, for instance, who doesn't speak English, will have a difficult time.
Yeah.
People aren't willing to stop and help. We don't trust strangers. We don't like them. We want our space. It's a basic animal thing. It's a fight for resource and for your own spirit and your animality. You know, I was in New York on tour just a week or two ago, and I take my vigorous walk to get some exercise, and I happen to have a midtown motel, and I walk by the Diamond District, and you know, they have barkers on the street, and I'm walking by, and a guy says to me, buy one, get one free. I just completely ignored him, walked by. However, if I wanted to have an interaction with him, I would have stopped and said this. If you were giving diamonds away for free by the bucket load, I still don't want them.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the truth of the matter.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean... Okay, so tying this into the book, let me see here. Well, you're talking about, you know, your own personal privacy, and I understand that tcboyle.com was recently hacked, and that you hired a man by the name Crackhead to sort this all out. What happened?
That's
here?
Not correct. I have a friend, and he's had some problems, but I did not name him when I spoke of him because I wouldn't want to embarrass him.
Yeah.
And I hope you won't.
No.
In fact, I hope you'll delete that reference to his name. Yes, he has had some problems, and it's as a result of these problems that he, by serendipity, happened to wash up. I haven't seen him in 6 years. I sometimes confuse... I'm so comfortable with what we're doing and enjoy it so much. I sometimes confuse a private conversation with a public one.
Yeah.
And I would not want to name him or anybody else, because I'm not that sort of person. So I hope you will delete that reference to his name. I made the mistake of saying to the fans that Milo was gone. And I was going to do my best to put up the contest and the latest what's new and so on, but that I don't have technological ability to do that. The hacker came at us then. Mm-hmm. And I believe I know who it is. I believe it is a disgruntled fan who has been banned. But I can't say. If it were a spammer, then where are the ads? You know, it was just silence is golden and caught me at a vulnerable moment. Maybe I'm too unguarded with regard to these things. At any rate.
Well, my site was recently hacked, too, so it's any consolation.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But was it for spam purposes?
Well, people, there was a hacker who basically took all of my images and then replaced them somehow with, like, you know, his email addresses of him. You know, he wanted attention, apparently, and I had to go and find all the pictures again, and, you know...
You're a kind of technological guy. I am not. I am purely not. Like, my wife's brain works that way, my son's brain works that way, but mine does not. At any rate, this does work that way.
Yeah.
I mean, this... Let's cut the reference.
Leave
it out. This individual, he is... a genius. He's one of the first programmers, and he was very powerful in his industry and so on. And it happened that he needed a place to stay, he needed money, and I paid him, and within 5 days he was able to give us a great deal more security with a new server, and when my son comes back he will prettify the thing so that it's a little more accessible for people. But of course, when you have a web page that has a message board, you have to have access to the public, and yet you still have to prevent such things from happening.
Yeah.
There are a lot of anarchists out there, and I have a lot of enemies too. You know, to be in the position of attracting people to you, you attract people who are reasonable, you attract people who love you unreasonably, and you attract people who want to love you but feel rejected by you, and they may lash out and react in a negative way. So it's I'm vulnerable to it, and so are you.
How does fiction then find a kind of solution between this public to private, you know, ratio here? Then, I mean, how do you talk in part is sort of way to get people to dwell upon this, or, you know, is this something that you might explore in the future?
I don't know. Again, if you looked at the stories in Tooth and Claw, yeah, you'll see that all but one have current settings.
Yeah.
Normally, I'm working out my questions of society in the short stories. But, you know, for instance, A Friend of the Earth, it was set in 1980 and 2025, but still I could call that a contemporary idea. Mm-hmm. I'm dealing with global warming, which, by the way, I intend to return to eventually, or more ecological things in the novel beyond the one I'm working on now. In this case of identity theft, I saw just that word in my idea book, and I realized that I wanted to delve into it more deeply than I could in a short story. Now, I had never conceived it first as a short story. It was just an idea. Mm-hmm. I conceived it as a novel because it, of all the things we've talked about, all the ramifications of what's happening to us as individuals, I just wanted to explore that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of, like, you know, dwindling kinds of voices, going back to, again, our previous conversation, and you also recently kind of publicly made some comments about that have been making the rounds.
I didn't. In fact, I
really
did not name her, and I would like you to eliminate that from this conversation, too.
Okay.
I did not. I addressed a critic, mm-hmm, and maybe people can make that connection. But again, I'm not the sort of guy who would make critical comments about anyone by name. And further, you may notice that I often like to bait the critics in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way. For instance, last time I was here, I did the arts and lectures. And, you know, here's hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people, and they love me, and I love them, and I did the whole thing. And the last question was, what do you think of the critics? And here was my response, more or less. It's like, well, you people know that I believe in Darwinian evolution. And so you have the elephant, for instance. It's a magnificent animal. It's got a great brain. It has no enemies. But there's a niche there, and so you have the elephant tick. That was the end of the response. And the audience was stunned. They didn't know what to say. And then they realized that I'm having fun. In fact, with regard to the review in question, I hadn't even read it when I was on Lenny's show. Huh. And I'm just doing a little probing and poking. I have since read it. And it's really quite a generous and good review. I disagree with this particular critic's take on the ending, and felt that perhaps this person should not have impugned my working method. I think that you know.
Yeah.
And that this critic should know that, of course, I'm under no obligation to whip out a novel. I mean, I'm not a thriller writer who needs to pay the rent. I do exactly what I please. And many other reviewers have found the ending to be very satisfying in the way that I had hoped. So everyone has the right to his or her opinion, and I have no problems with that. In fact, whenever I respond to the critics, it's usually in general terms, and it's usually kind of for fun. The truth is that without the critics, from the very beginning, they have been behind me. Obviously, everyone is irritated by unfair criticism, and in this case, it wasn't at all. The kind of criticism that I got for The Tortilla Curtain, for instance, where I was attacked purely on political grounds, didn't matter what I was writing, or, you know, they just hated the notion that I had the audacity to try to portray a Mexican immigrant, and etc., that kind of thing. That, I think, is very wrong. But as far as a legitimate critic, of course you have the right to their opinion, and I'm usually just having fun with it, believe me. And I am not the sort of person, which is why I want you to eliminate these two names. I did not mention any names, and never would, mm-hmm, simply because I could, of course. Why not? You know, Jesus, Norman Mailer and Gore Vidal punched each other, you know?
Yeah.
It's just not my way. Mm. I'm kind of more sardonic and sly. And sometimes I think people mistake what I say. You'd be surprised. Mainly because I say things with a straight face.
Yeah. That's always, you're probably good at poker too, I'm guessing.
I don't gamble because I have no faith in winning. This kind of sardonic sense of humor is something I grew up with in a very radical left-wing community. And I was very insular. I grew up in New York in this community. And I felt that everybody is like me and everybody feels the same way and gets the same kind of humor. And I find that that's wrong. Mm. And I particularly find it when I go to the movies and I'm watching the coming attractions. When I laugh, it's not when the audience laughs. And I'm laughing because of the manipulation and the idiocy and how the audience is manipulated. They laugh. And please, I'm not looking down on them too much, just a little bit. They laugh because they are being manipulated. They're supposed to laugh. This is the standard routine. They've learned it from TV. Well, there's not a laugh track in the movies, but they're laughing where the laugh track would prompt them. I'm kind of out of lockstep with that. I know that. And yet still I want to reach out and communicate to that audience. Maybe I never will because my sense of humor doesn't work that way.
Well, simultaneously, Talk Talk seems to be, I saw that it was in the top 100 on Amazon, so people are buying the book.
I have never looked at Amazon in my life. You know why? Self-protection.
Yeah.
I don't want to know. I really don't want to know.
Yeah.
You know what's going on here? This woman with the case who just came in? Mm-hmm. I knew nothing about this sort of thing. I was invited to a restaurant that some friends have, and I was sitting there having a glass of wine, and in came a lovely woman and a lovely man with a case like this with bottles of wine in them. They are selling the wine to the people at the bar and then giving me and everybody else a taste to it. Oh, what fun. What a great concept. I don't really pay any attention to literary gossip whatsoever. I don't know anything about it because it doesn't interest me and I have no time for it. I'm much more concerned with living my own life in the way that I want to. As you know, given the exigencies of nature and the fact that we'll all be dead soon, sure. I do think that some of the bloggistas, as I understand it, and perhaps this individual you're referring to, whom I've never heard of, do these things for sensationalism, just to get people to pay attention. And from my point of view, if the blogs are saying this or that about me, first of all, I don't know. And yeah. secondly, I suppose it helps sell books.
Yeah.
There is a kind of edge of desperation to it, though, isn't there? Now, I don't know it. I don't know about you. But it's great if something untoward happens or something bizarre happens. And this guy you're talking about, if he writes the first line is that this is the worst novel of its time or whatever it is, well, he's going to get more attention than if he tries to give a reasoned evaluation. And so too in a writing workshop.
Yeah.
I think the first time I ever taught one, I was a student at Iowa. And I was very intent in what I'm doing and trying to help the students. And one guy said, can my friend come in on the day that my story is up? Of course he can come in, you know? And the friend was only a partisan, only an advocate. He didn't care about anything else. Mm-hmm. And one guy was saying, well, about the symbolism in your story? And the friend slammed his fist down and said, fuck symbolism! You know? So there are ways of criticism that are interpretive. And I think that's what good criticism is. It interprets. Of course, there's an evaluation and there's an opinion. But there can be any way of doing this in a writing workshop as well. And I think the ones that are out of control and the worst ones are where factions develop. And there's no interest in what the literature is or what it's conveying or its interpretation. It's, hey, man, you don't like me? I don't like you. Fuck you. And your work sucks. I mean, there's that level of criticism. And maybe that attracts an audience because it's kind of sensational. Ooh, somebody said that. But really, it's totally irrelevant. True criticism is interpretive.
Well, also, you know, what you're kind of drawing upon is a sort of competitive aspect to writing. And you once said that writing was second only to tennis as a competitive...
Which is why I don't play tennis anymore.
Yeah.
I was the tennis pro, you know, at our local courts.
Really?
For one summer. If I had to do it for one more week, I'd probably be in the mental hospital now. And I'm always amazed. I have a friend who still plays tennis. I can't imagine engaging in anything competitive because I don't want to lose and I would want to dedicate my entire life to assuring that I'm not going to. So I've chosen my arena, and yes, writing is competitive in the sense that We're all egomaniacs. We're all narcissists, like Peck, like Kellogg, like Kinsey. That's why I'm attracted to these people. And we want, for our own identities, to have to communicate with people in the most rigorous and vast way. And other writers are in our way for that audience. That said, of course, if it weren't for the other writers, we would be having a conversation only with the audience. And I think that culture gives us a mix, not only of writers, but all the other arts and the nonfiction writers and the bloggers and the evil critics and everybody else, you know? And our job is to kind of live in it and sort it out. But of course, I know about literature. And I think that, you asked about a thriller. A thriller to me is a one-dimensional thing. I guess then nothing can be one-dimensional. Okay, a two-dimensional thing. Which exists only to tell a story and does not have any exploration in it or any depth or any meaning to what is it about. Which is why I don't consider what I've done a thriller. I wouldn't want to label it in that way. Although, again, for the purpose of my publisher, I think they'd like to call it a thriller to attract this other audience.
But why can't a thriller have depth? I mean,
of course it can, yeah. but I don't know of them. Yeah. Do you consider Graham Greene's books to be thrillers? He himself divided them into his serious work and his entertainments. I would never do that with my own work. Yeah. I have written in so many modes. I've written stories like The Champ about the eating contest. Mm-hmm. It's purely enjoyable in a slapstick kind of way. And then I've written things like Chicxulub that made a woman sob in the audience when I read it aloud, and everything in between. Mm-hmm. I would never make that distinction. Are Graham Greene's books thrillers? If so, then I have read thrillers, you know?
Yeah. Well, I know. It all depends on
but who's whatever making, is the yeah. stuff that's on the top 10 of the bestseller, I'd never heard of these writers. In fact, I remember some years ago, we had a bookstore in Woodland Hills where I was living, and it had a rack that wouldn't include trade paperbacks, only the smaller paperbacks. And every once in a while, I'd go in there and be bewildered. There are thousands of books presumably selling so well in genres, and I've never heard of a single writer there.
Yeah.
I remember also, I was trying to get some acknowledgement, and my wife and my daughter, who was very young then, went in, and my wife was going to casually ask if they had any T.C. Boyle books. And if they didn't, well, of course they didn't, perhaps they should order some, because she was a disinterested customer and just interested in this terrific writer. And my daughter said, and yeah, he's my daddy. But there's a whole other world out there that I don't know about in terms of writing. And of course, sometimes I'm on stage with these people. Sometimes people say, well, in your company, you're publishing so-and-so, and they're writing vampire novels, and they're outselling you by 10-1. Sure, publishing is a business. They're not altruists. They're not there just to give us the greatest of literature. They're trying to sell a product. I have no problem with that.
But you were describing to me earlier how you have this desire to want to reach that audience who is pre-programmed to laugh at the trailers.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, one
reach
might say,
them only on my own terms. Hmm. Only on my own terms, from word of mouth. And it has happened to me through some of my books, like Budding Prospects. There are people of that mindset who probably have only read Budding Prospects of all my books. The Tortilla Curtain has reached a huge audience. It's a classic. I mean, every kid reads it in California in their junior year and in many other states. In Germany, every kid reads it for their exams. This is a reach beyond my normal audience, the audience that reads the New York Times Book Review, for instance. I want to reach beyond that audience because I believe in what I do, and I believe that people would be more engaged, be happier, have better sex lives, live longer if they read my books instead of the crap, you know? But I'm not going to calculate how to reach them. I believe that I will reach them through word of mouth.
But at the same time, though, Talk gets snapped up for the film rights rather quickly
before
publication. I'm
so pleased. It's the first time it's ever happened to me before publication. Yeah. And again, I don't work in the films. I see films as a great advertisement for the book. I hope that Gary Flader and Universal Pictures make a movie. I hope they make it soon, and I hope it's great. I hope it attracts all of the people who don't know about me to the book.
Yeah.
But what is the likelihood of that? I don't know. 50-50? I'm not a gambling man.
Yeah.
90-10 against me? I hope for the best. Drop City is now going through the process. I hope that that becomes a movie. Tortilla Curtain is heating up again. I'm told that Kevin Costner is going to make it in the fall. Great, hallelujah. After the Plague has just been bought to make into a feature film. If any of these should happen, I will be better known and people may buy more of my books. Maybe they'll like them. Maybe they'll read all my books.
But who's to say whether your messages will be transmuted into something that is more commercial?
Of course. I mean, then again, my only choice is no movie or yes movie. Yeah. I say yes movie and hope for the best. I love The Road to Wellville. I pray that I get movies in my mind as good as that.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, some authors, Bello, I know there's one Bello movie, Seize the Day, but I believe Bello was one who was rather adamant about not selling film rights. He didn't want another version of what he's doing. I don't care because, yes, some people may only see The Road to Wellville. Maybe they hate the movie and they think I am a pathetic author. Okay. But I think it's more likely that people will be attracted to it and read the book and judge for themselves. And I don't mind having my work translated into different forums. I will never compromise a single word of what I do, nor will I ever calculate to try to get an audience. I simply do what I feel like doing as an artist, what comes next. But, for instance, I just recorded for Books on Tape, Talk Talk, Unabridged. It's a different version of what I've done. Other actors have done, there's four versions. I just did the Tortilla Curtain for Blackstone Audio, complete. That means there are three other versions of it, two by actors. Great, you know, fine. Maybe they would read it differently from how I would, maybe better, maybe worse. But I'm delighted that there are other versions and people can have access to it.
I guess, though, what I'm sort of suggesting here is that, you know, given that our society has to subscribe to some degree by commercial impulses or by capitalistic impulses, we have to pay our rent, we have to, you know, pay our bills. I mean, certainly there's got to be some kind of overlap, you know, and there's some sort of Venn diagram here where Boyle meets commercial, you know.
Of course, Ed, of course. You know, I'm making a good living from my books. I'm very happy to do that. While I can see the larger picture of what capitalism is doing to us, because it's a Ponzi scheme. There aren't infinite consumers. There is not infinite product. Nonetheless, just as I can see that overpopulation is taking over the world, I still have three children, you know?
Yeah.
Nonetheless, I'm not a saint in that degree. I'm an animal. I'm living here. I'm doing what I'm doing. But more than anything, I have been lucky enough to be an artist who has always had a small following that's grown and grown and grown, so that I can pay the bills. I'm very happy about that and very lucky. And I know that many artists and many great artists have not been able to do that. And I'm pleased to go out on the road and help my publisher. I feel I owe them something. I feel I owe them a debt. They're taking a chance on me. They're the ones who are engaged in commerce. They're the ones who have to have a bottom line. They're the ones who put me in the hotel and invite you to come talk to me. All of that, I am grateful for that, and I want to help them sell books, absolutely. And I'm good at it. I give a good performance. I'm not giving a good performance, though, in order to sell books specifically. I'm giving a good performance because I have honor. I want to give a good performance. If you come to see me, I'm not just going to sit behind a desk and sign books and hand them back to you. I want to give you something in return. That's how I feel. Some authors don't feel that. I've been on stage in book fairs with authors. They don't give a damn about the audience or anybody else. They even talk to them. They just want to get a certain number sold at a certain time, you know? I'm not that kind of animal.
How do you sort of, you know, inure yourself completely to this whole sort of outside commercial prospect when you are, like, you know, writing a book like Talk Talk or The Tortilla Curtain or a short story? I mean, you know, inevitably it's going to creep up on you.
Here's the difficult thing.
Yeah.
It happens with every book.
Yeah.
I am sitting here doing interviews and talking about a book that I've practically forgotten about because it's a year ago and I'm well into the next project. And often, mostly, and again, to speak to the critics, critics have supported me, and from the beginning, I would say 90% of the reviews are usually quite favorable, and not only favorable, but ones which seek to understand, and the great ones, in my mind anyway, you know, the ones that touch me are ones where people do kind of get what I hope they'd get. I mean, that's wonderful. But the difficult thing is, when that process is happening, I always think, well, wow, I should write another book like this. Mm-hmm. I should be doing more of this. But in fact, I'm doing something utterly, polarly, the polar opposite of this. That's where it's hard. Not in the process of writing a new story, but in the process of being praised for one and trying to sell it and selling it and being successful with it, the temptation to say, wow, why don't I write another one? Why don't I do the sequel? But that's not how I work. I would never do that.
Then what do you do then to sort of just completely throw yourself into a totally different swimming pool?
I give the cell phone back to Milo when I get home, and I'm in another world. And nothing bothers me and nothing engages me except the project I'm working on. So I'm very much able, I think more than most people, to have two separate existences. As you know, I'm a very gregarious guy. I'm a ham. I love to be on stage. I'm a good performer. I value that. It's something I want to do. And I put everything I have into my work. And I would not release it unless I'm completely satisfied that it is exactly what I want. Once that's done, however, the essay we talked about last time, This Monkey, My Back,
yeah.
I then need to do something else. I don't look backward. When I did the collected stories, I know some authors will think, wow, it's a great idea, I could do it better now. I would never consider that.
Yeah.
That is an artifact. That's part of something that, for whoever might be interested, this is the way it was. Now I only want to move forward. And incidentally, I think, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years from now, if I live that long and I continue to be productive, we might have the Collected Stories Volume 2. I hope so. Well, I got 2.5 collections. I think the last one collected four of them, so
yeah,
I've got 2.5.
There you go. I actually wanted to talk with you about a specific passage that was interesting to me in Talk Talk, bringing it back to the novel in question. The imagery in this book takes on, I think, a more sort of cartoonish and subjective quality than I think, you know, we've normally seen from you. There's one particular piece of imagery I want to actually read. It's the two women in the taqueria.
Go to it, Ed.
Yeah, and you describe them as two supersized white women with unevenly dyed hair, travelers like themselves who were staring moodily down at the foil-wrapped remains of their burritos and clutching bottles of Don Equis as if they were fire extinguishers. Now...
God, that's beautiful.
Well, it's
who wrote that?
The thing is there's a certain interesting editorialization in this imagery that I wanted to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are the women described as supersized? Why can't they be described as hefty or at least, you know, have their sort of, you know, overweight status not necessarily, you know, fit neatly within that McDonald's paradigm?
We have to tie it to point of view. I think when you do a very close third person, yes, it allows the author to sneak in and be satiric now and again, but basically, would the observer think this way? And I think it enriches the character of whoever is observing. I did an interview recently in which the first question from the guy was, so, you don't like tattoos on women, huh? Peck doesn't like tattoos on women. In fact, I don't either, but you can't make a one-on-one judgment. And I admitted to him, yes, of course, I do not. I'm not maybe as adamant about it as Peck. But sure, certain elements of who I am will filter into these characters. But still, I want to give them an individual perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not necessarily grinding an axe through the point of view of somebody else. But I want to give them an original perspective. And so this is the observation of the character. And yes, of course, the author is in there manipulating this, sure.
But since you're jumping around from, you know, your usual dual narrative kind of idea here, then there is, of course, a greater risk that it will be perceived as, oh, Boyle perceives these two women as supersized or as...
Well, why not? Who cares? I mean, I've been known as a satirist all my life.
Well, certainly, but at the same time, isn't there something to be said for, like, the telling detail, like the actual grip around the actual... you know, glass, or rather the bottle should actually tell the story rather than, like, you know, comparing it to a fire extinguisher?
I'm not following you, Ed.
I guess what I'm saying is that there's a case here, I suppose, that can be made about, like, just something is as it is. It's a detail that essentially tells...
Well, you mean making an image, spinning an image out?
Yeah, so the image
okay.
It leaves up to the audience to sort of, like, parse and perceive
the
fact that, like, the grip around the bottle simply tells that bottle is important to them, you know?
Sure, okay, yeah. There's an element we're leaving out of this discussion. Fun.
Yeah, okay.
Fun. It is fun for me. I'd forgotten entirely about that line. I enjoyed hearing you read it. I think it's pretty damn hilarious.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with it. Yes, this is basically a non-comic novel. It's in a non-comic tone and mode. But that doesn't mean to say that there aren't things in here that I find amusing.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Well, I found a few things amusing, too. Like the fact that the boss of Bridger's boss, he doesn't even know what country he comes from.
Yeah. So, of course, there's always a mix of these elements, even though the mode of this is non-comic.
Mm-hmm.
And there is fun. There is an element of fun. And just the rhythm of that sentence as you read it is enjoyable to me. Yes, maybe I could be more restrained and show a more documentary view of these women.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel like that at that time. And I didn't feel, I felt like my characters are irritated. You know, they're angry. And maybe they are given to sardonic musings themselves. And I think as Dana evolved, she is not a typical victim. She is a woman who is angry. And as an angry woman, maybe some of her, in other areas of this book, maybe when we're in her point of view, some of her view of this is nasty, even nasty sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think that is inherent in her character, and I think it makes her a more interesting and deeper character than someone who might give a documentary view of something. I think maybe her viewpoint sometimes reflects her upset, you know, her anxiety.
That's true. The other question I wanted to ask you about this book, well, there's a number of them, but this one involves the financial resources that Dana and Bridger seem to have. It's a little bit suspect given the fact that their credit histories have been tarnished. Was this something that was just not as important or, you know...
Give me an example.
Well, how do they have the ability to go ahead and pay for dinner and pay for the hotel rooms when this, you know, thief has essentially absconded with their
credit
history?
Well, don't forget that before they leave on their trip, Dana has gone to the credit reporting agencies and the credit card agencies, canceled the cards, and got new ones. And there will be then a warning on her credit reports so that no one else can open new credit cards in her name. This is the way it works.
Yeah.
So that she has new credit cards. She has a bank balance. Peck didn't drain her bank balance. She didn't have to pay any of those bills that came because she demonstrated that she was a victim of this fraud, and now it's going through the internal process of the insurance companies and so on. Now they might harass her, and many cases of identity theft people have been really held over the barrel for this, but in most cases it is resolved through insurance. So she's got new credit cards. She still has a bank balance. She's got new credit limits and new credit cards.
Hmm, okay. Well, I mean, because that was...
Bridger's get maxed out once.
Yeah.
Peck does that just to hurt him.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
His cards no longer work. But you did this. This is the way this thing works. If you catch it and report it to the credit card agencies, get the document from the police, incidentally. This is not to say that the creditors will back off.
Yeah.
But... at this state, she's still in that limbo, and she has new credit cards.
I guess I just had confusion because, you know, there's two Dana Bridgers. There's the whole sort of, you know, police situation that isn't entirely resolved. And it just seems suspect to me.
The police, in truth, are getting more hip to this crime. It is no longer being called a victimless crime.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, it is as it is in the book. They are not really interested in pursuing it. They've got rapists and murderers and so on. They got drunks in the street.
Yeah.
And this is a crime that the insurance companies will suss out eventually. And what happened to Dana is a fact. It's happened to many, many people where they've been arrested by someone else who's committed crimes in their identity. But it is resolvable. And she does go to the victim's assistance people, and she does cancel her cards, and she has been listed as a victim of identity theft, and she has been issued new cards. That's how she is able to pay, and Bridger is not. He, presumably, will go through that process, too. By the very end of the book, we presume that he has.
Yeah. Okay.
You're a good reader, Ed.
I do try. Well, the one thing that was interesting to me also was Peck's hard prison stare. Oh, no, forget that. If I have to ask you one question, the egrets. There are egrets throughout this book, and I wanted to know what the exact purpose, why egrets? Are you sort of, you know, a closet ornithologist, or...
Well, you know how much I love nature, but no,
yeah,
it's simply because of the location of his apartment.
Yeah.
In Mill Valley on Shelter Bay. And the egret colony is on Highway 1 over the hill, over Mount Tam on the other side.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah, they're okay. there. It's just a little fact of, and it's also, it's a fact of the setting, but it's also magical. It's very magical to see these birds, for me anyway, and it's particularly in the instance in which it appears in the mist on the railing. It's a wild thing come to them. Mm-hmm. That's something we haven't talked about, by the way. Hmm. Dana's novel, Wild Child.
That's true. Yeah.
Almost always, and there's no exception like this one, what I turn into my agent and my editor is exactly what you will see. Mm-hmm. In this case, both of them asked me to drop the Wild Child story. In the initial manuscript, the 66-page novella Wild Child that Dana wrote was attached as an appendix.
Really?
So you finish the book, and then you get to read Wild Child about the Wild Child of Aveyron. It's written in a very different style, of course, because Dana wrote it. More of a the kind of style that I love, in a, more of a folktale kind of style, you know, and a fairy tale kind of style. I thought it would be great. And even these Kmart readers, or whoever my publisher hopes to suck in by saying, hey, it's a thriller, you know,
I
felt even those periodists who don't know me would be interested to see what Dana had written. Maybe they wouldn't be bored by it, maybe they wouldn't read it, but they've already been totally satisfied by reading this book with its beautiful, brilliant, and totally fitting ending, and they could read this. I listened to them, they advised me against it, I dropped it. However, by the beauty of fate, it's in the current McSweeney's. And on this tour, I've had many, I don't know if McSweeney's has sold out or if they published again or what, but I've had many, many people standing in line waving this thing. So they've gotten to read it as I originally intended. They've gotten to read the appendix as well. Mm-hmm. And I loved the idea. But still, as I went back in the book, you still know that she's writing it and you know what the story is, so that you can make your own judgments about how this deepens the idea or the meditation on identity and language. He was the Wild Child of Aveyron, as we know the story is very familiar, was a feral child and never able to acquire language despite the best efforts of his teacher. And I love the story. It's been told before. In fact, it's mentioned in the book. There's a lot of movie stuff in this book, if you noticed.
Yeah.
Kurosawa,
yeah.
With his three narratives. And also the fact that Truffaut had made a beautiful version of this. I got it, by the way. I hadn't seen it since it came out. I got it. Mm-hmm. And then I decided not to watch it because I didn't want it to interfere with my telling of the Wild Child. Now I can watch it again, and I will at some point.
There's also Bruno Kay and Werner Herzog's version of that story, too.
I love Herzog's movie.
The other thing that no review has actually pointed out, and I was actually surprised, is the comparison between the title and the 1980s music band. It's an absolute cheeseball question, but it has to be asked.
Well, as soon as one of my fans heard the title, he gave me a CD of this band called Talk Talk.
Yeah.
I haven't listened to it, and I don't know of them. I think their name is vaguely in my mind somewhere. I did have an association, although it's just an association that doesn't have any meaning for this novel, with the actual song Talk Talk, which I now realize, because of these discussions, was done by a band called The Music Machine, I think, around 65 or so. I have a guy I've met through my books who is a member of a popular band, and he is a musicologist of that period of pop, rock and roll from like 63 to 67 or so. He's a wonderful, great man, incredibly literate, great man, and he sends me CDs of this stuff, and on one of them was this wonderful song, Talk Talk. It is, if we ever make a movie of Drop City, I'd love that to be in it. It's great. But the band Talk Talk itself, I don't know of. I don't know their music, and I should listen, but I haven't. The title comes from, as explained in the book, a translation from sign language into English of talking a lot. The gesture for talk is like this.
Yeah.
And if you're just talking, it's this. If you talk a lot, it's double. So the direct translation would be talk, talk, to talk a lot. So to me, it speaks to the idea of communication and language as that identifies who we are.
Yeah. Well, in the preface of this book, you note that, or in the little, you know, foreword, you sort of say that, you know, that you are not trying to take away from that particular sort of language. I was wondering if you attempted to learn ASL during the course of this, or...
I did, however, and I wanted to take a course in it, but I wasn't able to because I didn't have time. I have a deaf friend who helped, and I have dictionaries. There are dictionaries, pictorial dictionaries of ASL to show you the signs, and I was able to use that so that I could suggest signs at a given time. Literal translations from ASL to English are like a translation from French to English or and back and forth are very dicey and very problematic. I felt I would rather communicate the actual thought of what they are saying in our language rather than try to communicate exactly. On three or four occasions, I do communicate the exact translation just to show you what it'd be like to suggest. It's like, for instance, when you're using a dialect in a story, you have to suggest the dialect, but if you overuse it, it becomes a device in itself and it pulls the reader away from the story. So I think I was probably conscious of this and trying to suggest what it might be like, but not to give it to you verbatim, because I think it would distance you from the text.
Gotcha. Well, with that in mind, I think we are... Yes, we're way over. So, Tom, it was a pleasure chatting with you again, and hopefully we shall chat again.
As always, Ed, you're a great reader and a tough guy. I like your questions.